From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Manufacturers in Michigan are starting to feel ripple effects from the new coronavirus.
In the end, we could have our customer plants that have to be idled.
One parts maker will tell us about quarantines on the supply chain. Also on the program, the Line 5 project you haven't heard about. Enbridge is moving forward on a subset of the pipeline rebuild, this one under the St. Clair River. On the other side of the state, the EPA is getting in gear to clean up groundwater pollution in Charlevoix, nearly 3 decades after affirming it wouldn't be a problem. We'll check in on what changed. And we listen to family stories of Michigan's Black pioneers.
Either I would go looking for stories, or sometimes I felt like they came looking for me.
Finding history takes records and a sense of imagination. Those stories and more just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On the show today, Enbridge Energy's plan to build a tunnel under the Straits of Mackinac. It's gotten a lot of attention, but the company is also gearing up to replace a section of its Line 5 pipe running beneath the St. Clair River.
Next month, they'll start to weld together the 2,800-foot-long pipe.
We'll get more details from Michigan Radio's Lester Graham later on this hour. But first, half a world away from Michigan, public health authorities are watching closely to see how the end of an extended holiday break might affect the spread of the new coronavirus. It has infected more than 40,000 people globally and killed more than 900 people. Michigan has no confirmed cases yet, but within the casualty lists, keep an eye on the state's manufacturing businesses. A number of Western Michigan manufacturing companies have experienced production delays and stoppages because of the public health situation in China. Peter Hungerford is the COO for ADAC Automotive, a supplier with offices in Troy, Saranac, and Grand Rapids. Peter Hungerford, welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you very much, April.
Can you tell me about your company's relationship with factories and supply chain in China and how you work together?
Sure. Well, over the years, we have an alliance called the VAST Alliance, and we have two facilities in China that produce automotive components, not only for the China automotive market, but we do have some export from those regions to support our North American customers as well.
How many Chinese companies would you say you interact with?
Quite a few. Primarily, we have some chrome plater suppliers and some tooling providers. And over the years, we've moved some of that production there. We bring it back, and slowly we've been doing some more tooling and chrome plating supply from the Americas.
When did you start hearing about the virus?
Actually, we heard about it from some of our Chinese colleagues. You know, we've been doing business over there, for over 10 years now, and for some of our tooling suppliers, even longer. So we had heard rumblings that there was some health concerns over there, and as we began to interact with our Chinese colleagues, we began to learn how serious it was.
I read that ADAC actually had someone in Wuhan during the initial outbreak.
Yeah, we did. We had one employee who was there on business and then was there for an extra week on holiday. Fortunately, this person found a less populated area to stay until he could arrange travel out of the country. This person finally made it onto a flight arranged by the U.S. Embassy and is currently in an Air Force hotel until the 14-day incubation period's passed.
So you still haven't seen him yet?
We haven't, but we've talked to him. We know he's safe.
What were you thinking when you heard that he was under these constraints, that there were roadblocks, that he was having trouble getting around, and just like actual physical constraints on his person as well as to the business?
Well, first we wanted to ensure he was safe. When we heard that not only the hotel he was staying at, they evacuated that, but there weren't other places for some other people to stay, we were really worried about his safety and was he going to be able to find a place to, you know, kind of get out of the population, be able to then continue to have communication and begin to coordinate with the U.S. Embassy. So fortunately, where he ultimately ended up, he did have cell coverage, and I personally talked to him only a few days later, and he felt safe, which made me feel better, and he had already made arrangements getting onto the U.S. Embassy website, getting his name in the queue, etc. So knowing this person and the time that they have spent in China, fortunately, he had the resources and the means to get himself in a position to stay safe and get home.
At what point did the quarantines and other measures in China start to affect the business's operations?
Yeah. Well, you know, for many automotive suppliers, many of us have global supply chains. You know, China continues to have very competitive suppliers for components, electronics, and tooling. Since the factories and the trade shops have stopped working, you know, we're evaluating our supply and our project timing. This week, we're expecting work to resume, but it could take another 1 to 2 weeks before full production resumes. Therefore, you know, with the lead time to ship components and tools of 6 to 12 weeks, you know, we're working on contingency plans on, you know, can we find alternative sources of supply, or can we get the tools out earlier, et cetera. So for us, you know, we have been working with our suppliers over there, validating we have supply, but it is time that we begin to finalize these contingency plans.
Are your partners in China able to tell you anything about, you know, they say, you know, you may be able to come up with some workarounds over the next couple of weeks, but are they able to tell you anything from China about when they'll be back in production?
They are to some degree. This week, I think, is a big week for us. By the end of the week, if we have even half the teams back producing product, whether it's our own facilities there or with our supplier partners, you know, that'll say a lot. The most information we've gotten up to this point is what the requirements are to open the facility, get people back into the plant, and get the operations back up and running. Up to this point, literally up until today, you know, the facilities were all shut down, so we were not sure when exactly production was going to start. But we do know, talking with them, that they have people in there cleaning the facilities, and this week production should resume.
Yeah, we'd heard that Chinese companies were encouraging employees to work from home when possible. That's fine for an office job, but this just sounds like a completely different ball game to enforce in the manufacturing sector.
It is. You know, without people coming into the facilities, having time on the machines, building parts, and then shipping parts, you know, things don't get done when they work from home.
Can you tell us a little bit about what it looks like to find some other supply chain options? I mean, does that literally mean quickly forging some alliances with manufacturing companies in other countries?
Yeah. Well, fortunately, you know, there's been a lot that's been gone on with, you know, frankly, geopolitical issues. So we've had some forethought into trying to mitigate our risk there. China is and will remain the largest automotive market in the world. So our facilities there are going to continue to produce, continue to serve that market, and probably continue to serve the greater Asia market. But as we look at the amount of production and supply that comes from China to either our European colleagues or our North American operations, we've already taken some steps to mitigate that. Therefore, we have some suppliers that we can go to. The big constraint would be the tooling and ensuring that the product that we produce from a different location meets the requirements of our customers, where, you know, in a vehicle, they can be pretty sophisticated and have to be very reliable. So that's the bigger challenge, the lead time to get tooling, the lead time to ensure the proper validation is taking place with any product if we were to set up an alternative source of supply.
Peter, do you feel like you've had to become experts in public health at ADAC, which is, at the end of the day, a manufacturer of component parts?
A little bit. You know, I myself, for about 2 weeks, was monitoring the World Health Organization, the CDC, looking into what does this mean, comparing it to SARS. And, you know, to some degree, until you're in the middle of it and it really affects you, you don't take the time to get into some of the details. And we have, to some level, had to learn about these things so we could try to predict and get out ahead of it. I'm glad we have, but now I think there's a lot of information regarding it, and we're, you know, clearly following and almost solely following the CDC website and their travel advisories.
You know, I heard what you said, that there are some measures that the company is taking to come up with alternatives, both in the short term and the long term. But what happens downstream from ADAC if you can't fill orders?
Yeah. Well, in the end, we could have our customer supply or our customer plants that have to be idled. Right, and that's not just an ADAC thing. They have a multitude of suppliers that are all doing the same thing. So we're all working very, very hard to find this continuity of supply to ensure that their facilities can keep running. That's our number one job, is to protect our customers, to protect their production. You know, we've been through a lot of challenges in my career and as an automotive supplier, and we seldom think about what would happen if we can't supply. And I'm pretty confident we're going to find a way to ensure that we do protect our customers. As somewhat uncertain as it can be, we have an industry and team members and supply partners that always find a way. So I'm going to believe that we're going to find a way through this too if it gets even more severe.
In your experience, how would you say this rates with some other stoppages for other causes that you've been through?
Oh, on a scale of 1 to 5, this is probably a 3.5.
What are you keeping an eye on as we move forward and the Chinese government hopefully, you know, continues its effort to keep the spread of the disease to a minimum?
What I'm watching more than China is India. You know, if somehow this, because we have business in India as well, if this continues to spread and it gets into a country like India, it's going to be an even bigger issue. China, in my opinion, is probably one of the only countries in the world that can actually shut down cities on a short notice, simply because of the centrally planned government. A place like India, crime, and even in the U.S., can you imagine us trying to shut down Chicago? I don't think that would work very well, but China can do it. So I'm kind of watching to see, is it going to get outside of China and spread in other countries?
Well, Peter Hungerford, thank you so much for talking with us today.
It's my pleasure.
Peter Hungerford is the COO of ADAC Automotive. Coming up, we'll talk with a University of Michigan business professor about the bigger picture and what the new coronavirus might mean to the global economy over the next couple of years. Plus, later in the program, Charlevoix in northern Michigan. It's known for its beautiful views and, the mushroom-shaped houses. But now the Environmental Protection Agency is calling for new cleanup at a pollution site in the city's downtown area, nearly 3 decades after the EPA knew about it.
I'm really just so grateful, I really am, that this is being addressed and getting handled. And it's finally.
That story's coming up in just about 15 minutes. Stay with us. You're with Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm April Baer. Some market watchers are projecting that work stoppages in China due to the new coronavirus will have a chilling effect on global economic growth. We just heard some indications of that. But aside from specific manufacturing stories here at home, how big might we expect a stall to be? Michigan has proved itself particularly vulnerable to disruptions in a global supply chain. Here to help us better understand what to look for is Ravi Anupindi, professor at the University of Michigan Ross School of Business. Ravi Anupindi, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you, April.
Do you see indications that the coronavirus quarantine is having an immediate chilling effect on the global economy?
Global economy, some. Not yet. We are beginning to see in economies that are closer to China. So, for example, Hyundai just announced that in South Korea there have been production shutdowns. So one way to kind of think about this is how far away are you from the center of the quote-unquote impact, right? And we are oceans away, so we'll have to see that. And not yet any significant impact. As Peter in the earlier segment talked about, that this week is critical week. That is, as the countries coming out of the New Year holidays, they've already delayed production launch start by about a week or so. So I think the next 2 weeks is going to be critical. How quickly can they ramp up? How many people are going to show up? And can they get to full capacity? So that's going to be very informative about whether we will begin to see impacts in the United States or not.
How long would the outbreak and perhaps the stoppages have to last in order to constitute a long-term detriment?
Well, one way to think about it is, even before we get to really long term, is short to medium term, is it takes about, most of the stuff we're talking about here, especially if you look at automotive sector, is coming via the ocean. So it takes about 2 weeks to get to the Pacific and about another 10 days to get to the Atlantic. So if you look at that, about 2 to 3 weeks, so anything that is sitting in the ocean, that much inventory probably is there in the ocean freights coming in. But if the production gets delayed and doesn't get ramped up beyond that, then we will begin to see the impacts here. So I would say we'll have to see, and we will know the status of the ramp up in the next 2 weeks. And if things are slowing down and not catching up enough, then I would begin to worry about it.
We've read that the parts of China most directly impacted economically by the outbreak of coronavirus are those that have ties to the auto industry.
Yes.
It's understandable. Does that mean that the impact of coronavirus would be felt more strongly in states like Michigan that also have a strong interest in the industry?
Yes, partly. If you look at, definitely, I think what I've seen about 50, the Wuhan area where this main impact is, about 50% of all the production is actually automotive related. And so, yes, so what you point out is important, and we should see the impact on Michigan much more than other states for that reason. As well as the other one is that, yes, technology is, U.S. depends a lot on the technology sector also in terms of assembly of electronic gadgets, et cetera. But then those can be air freighted as well.
You know, China has become such an integral part of the global economy, both in terms of its place within manufacturing, but also in terms of being a market.
Yes.
Is it realistic for American companies to just find other places to take care of their business, whether it's making or buying or selling, while still staying competitive? I mean, can we even think about the global equation without China being a part of it?
Long term, no. Not. I mean, China will continue to play an important role. But as Peter was mentioning earlier, you know, I think even before this virus impact, given all the trade issues, tensions that were going on, you know, companies are beginning to already think through about the role of China, and even longer term, if the costs in China have been rising. So he mentioned India, he mentioned other countries. So companies have begun to think through about spreading their supply chain a little bit wider, either for economic reasons or for other kind of risk reasons, whether it's trade or, you know, this happens to be just an external shock that has come. And in some ways, it came at a better time, and there is no better time for any virus.
Right.
But the fact that it came during the holidays, historically, this time, everybody is prepared, because what happens is production comes to a halt.
It is a pause in the natural.
It's a pause
calendar.
In the natural, cycle of how the country works. So people had, you know, the way people have reacted is, businesses have reacted is, they would build up inventory already. So in some sense, this week it becomes a critical thing. So, yeah. But broadly, I think, you know, yes, he talked about the challenges in terms of tooling cost and all that stuff, but companies have been thinking about diversifying their supply chains.
The Chinese central government has made some kinds of moves toward loosening up lending in preparation for, you know, what may be a slow time. Is there anything that can be done here in the U.S. or in China's other partners to stem the losses?
Losses for U.S. companies, or I don't see yet the losses coming in. I mean, I think because the impact really is I doubt, because I think China would control this stuff. It's going to be a huge impact, if at all. This week is the week to watch. The other piece would be, as you mentioned, China also is a big economy now. And not only Michigan, United States and Michigan also exports a lot to China. What is the impact of that? It's something to think about.
We just have a minute left.
Yes.
Many have noted that China's economy is far more open now than it was when SARS first struck, causing losses. Do you see the Chinese economy being able to weather what's happening?
Oh, they'll ultimately weather, yeah. I think, you know, China, the government of China believes this is super important, so they will make sure that this is... they will spring back from this. I have no doubt about that. Yeah.
Ravi Anupindi is professor at the University of Michigan Ross School of Business. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, April. I appreciate it.
Just a final note. A lot of the coronavirus news may sound alarmist or scary, but to keep things in perspective, Michigan's experienced only 5 suspected cases, and none of them have tested positive for coronavirus. The far greater public health risk domestically. Influenza is as strong as ever. A total of 403 patient visits due to flu-like illnesses were reported in Michigan just during the past week. The Line 5 project at the Straits of Mackinac is under deep scrutiny. The pipeline would run directly under Lakes Michigan and Huron. Environmentalists, State Attorney General Dana Nessel, and many others are keeping an eye on every step of the process. Line 5 is designed to cross the upper and lower peninsulas to transport oil and liquid natural gases to Canada. But you've probably heard all that. But there's another piece you may not have heard as much about. Line 5 is also going under a body of water that's part of the Great Lakes. Here to tell us more is Lester Graham, lead reporter for the Environment Report. Lester, lovely to see you.
Hi.
So where is this other section of Line 5 located?
Okay, this is where the pipeline goes under the St. Clair River. It's at Marysville. That's just a little south of Port Huron. And then it comes out the other side in Sarnia, Ontario.
Obviously, Enbridge has wanted to replace parts of Line 5, saying they're just really old. Is this section as old as the rest of the pipeline?
Yeah, it was all installed about the mid-1950s.
Yeah, what's going on with it at that particular place?
Well, Enbridge wants to replace that section of Line 5. The preliminary work has already begun, and a spokesman for Enbridge, Ryan Duffy, says this is part of trying to allay any concerns about the safety of Line 5.
Well, it really goes back to our agreements with the state, and this is one part of those agreements where we are going above and beyond for safety, really, and just making what's been a safe pipeline there even safer, and doing what we call a horizontal directional drill that will move the pipeline below the lake bin.
Right. As I understand, it's like 4 or 5 feet below the bottom of the river now. How deep will it be with this horizontal direct drilling?
It'll be about 30 feet or so below the lake bed there at the St. Clair River.
Duffy says they'll be using something called horizontal directional drilling to install that section of Line 5 under the St. Clair River.
Horizontal directional drilling. How is that safer than the old pipe?
Well, that's a pretty good question. Here's what Duffy said about that.
So it would just, you know, be even safer than it is right now, because it would be under the riverbed where there wouldn't be any kind of anchor situation, and you also wouldn't have the chance of any kind of product ever getting out into the water, because it is buried into the riverbed.
Now, that last statement, buried under the riverbed, no chance of it getting out of the water, that might be disputed.
It sounded pretty definite.
Yeah, I looked up the makeup of the substrate in that area. There's Bedford shale and Antrim shale found along the St. Clair River near that area. Bedford shale is described by the U.S. Geological Survey as this kind of silty shale, which becomes siltier and sandier in its upper layers. But actually, that rock will be farther below the level where the Line 5 pipe will be installed. They are going to be going through a layer of what's called blue clay. Now, clay, as you probably know, is used a lot to line retention ponds and landfills and everything else. So it would offer some protection between the pipe and the river if it got ruptured. But whether that means oil wouldn't have any chance of getting into the water, that would not be so certain, I don't think. However, you know, Enbridge's Ryan Duffy also says there will be automatic shutoff valves on both the U.S. and the Canadian sides of the river.
So when's the work on this part of the project getting underway?
Well, actually, some crews are on the Canadian side doing a little preliminary work now. Next month, they'll start to weld together the 2,800-foot-long pipe, which will take some time. And then after that, from the U.S. side of the river, they'll pull the length of all that pipe through the drilled hole, and there will be the new Line 5 section.
Huh. Well, how normal is it to do it that way?
Yeah, it's actually used a lot. It's pretty common. Just 9 years ago, Enbridge used that same method to replace the length of Line 6B under the St. Clair River, right next to where they're working now. You might remember 6B was the pipeline that leaked more than 800,000 gallons of oil into a creek and eventually the Kalamazoo River near Marshall in 2010. That, of course, was the largest inland oil spill in U.S. history.
Lester, thanks for the update.
Sure.
Michigan Radio's Lester Graham. And just a note, Enbridge is a corporate sponsor of Michigan Radio. The city of Charlevoix is known for its vistas, its lighthouse, and fishing. If you've been there, it might surprise you to know that much of its downtown is a Superfund site. Pollution was first discovered in the city's groundwater in 1981, and since then, Charlevoix residents have used Lake Michigan for drinking water and called it good. Now, the Environmental Protection Agency is back and has some cleanup to do. One woman might be losing her home in the process. Interlochen Public Radio's Kay LaFond has more.
Barbara Godwin-Chulik bought her two-story building in downtown Charlevoix in 1980. It's got three apartments and commercial frontage. Chulik says it was perfect. Living space for her, a spot for her pottery studio downstairs, and rental income, which she needs to supplement the sale of her art.
You know, I felt like I was really, you know, doing pretty well. And then a year later, you know, it was a knock on the door from the local health department guy and a guy from the DNR.
Chulik's building previously housed a dry cleaner that used and dumped a chemical known as PCE. The soil beneath her home was contaminated.
And that began this whole almost 40 years of not knowing what was going to happen next.
In the next couple of years, Chulik has to decide whether to have her family home demolished. It all started in a pre-regulation era when several dry cleaners and a tool shop in Charlevoix used and dumped industrial solvents on their properties. In the 80s, plumes of cancer-causing PCE and TCE were found in Charlevoix's groundwater. It was declared a Superfund site. The EPA built the city a roughly $3 million plant to get their drinking water from Lake Michigan. Laws were made prohibiting drinking water wells in the area. And the state of Michigan did some soil cleanup under Chulik's home. This was in the 90s.
They did some kind of treatment and said to us, well, this should do the trick.
Chulik had to trust that because moving was never an option for her. She raised her family in the building. And then, through advances in science, we learned that pollution left in the ground can still harm people, even if they don't touch soil or use the groundwater. Toxic chemicals can come into buildings in the form of vapors through cracks in foundations and basements. It's called vapor intrusion, and the EPA has been looking for it in Charlevoix. They've equipped 16 buildings in town, including Chulik's, with vacuum systems that keep vapors from entering. They also found more contamination, including a pool of PCE 16 feet beneath Chulik's home. They want to tear down her building, compensate her for its value, remove all of that contaminated soil, and give her back a vacant lot. But she's worried she won't be given enough money to build a new home. And she's worried about her family's health after they lived on the site for decades.
This whole situation, I feel like, you know, I want to just do it all over again. I wish I could have been way more proactive instead of feeling invaded.
Chulik could say no to having her home demolished, but then cleanup would take longer, and the pollution under her building affects her neighbors. Nobody from the EPA was available for an interview, despite numerous requests from IPR. But we spoke with the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy. They're working closely with the EPA on the site, and they basically said, yeah, back in the 90s, we didn't know about vapor intrusion, and we didn't know about these other sources of contamination. And once we knew, we acted. The EPA's new proposed cleanup for all of Charlevoix will cost more than $15 million. In addition to Chulik's home, they want to demolish two other commercial buildings downtown in the next 3 years. In November of 2019, a 30-day public comment period opened on the EPA's new cleanup plan. And according to Mark Heidloff, there was lots of confusion about it at a public meeting in December.
The sense I have is that this is a thing that everybody thought was cleaned up 30 years ago.
Heidloff is Charlevoix's city manager. He calls the EPA's communication with residents before that meeting lackluster.
They cited at their first public meeting that sometimes the mail doesn't work well in northern Michigan, which I consider to be a slap in the face to all of us who live up here.
He wrote a letter to the EPA urging them to keep public comment open until this January, so Charlevoix residents could, quote, more thoughtfully engage.
I had very good conversations with Senator Stabenow's office and Representative Bergman's office, and thankfully the EPA has extended the public comment period.
We spoke with the pastor of a local church where the EPA is also testing, and he said they were helpful and answered his questions. He also thinks they were responsive to the complaints they got at the meeting. They encouraged the formation of a citizens group. Barb Chulik says now, at least, she feels less alone.
I'm really just so grateful, I really am, that this is being addressed and getting handled. And it's finally.
She still doesn't know what she's going to decide. But the EPA says if they can execute their cleanup plan the way they want, the groundwater should completely recover in 35 years. And again, if you want to visit, a reminder that Charlevoix's drinking water comes from Lake Michigan and is safe. I'm Kay LaFond.
That story was featured on Points North, a weekly show and podcast from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, just when did the first African-American settlers arrive in Michigan?
Along the Grand River or near Fort Detroit in the 1700s, you had Afro-French who were traveling this area, doing business in this area.
In a few moments, we'll explore the long history of the first Black Americans in Michigan. You're with Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. During America's Great Migration, millions of Southerners, both Black and white, came north to places like what we now call Michigan in an attempt to escape the economic entrenchment of the South. But just who were the first African Americans to make Michigan their home? Once again, it's time to check in on our state's history with help from our partners at the Michigan History Center. Annalisa Cox is a non-resident fellow with the Hutchins Center at Harvard University. She's the author of The Bone and Sinew of the Land, America's Forgotten Pioneers and the Struggle for Equality. She's based in West Michigan. Annalisa Cox, welcome to Stateside.
I am glad to be here. Thanks.
Can you just start us off with maybe what kind of person was in a position to come north or to the area that we now know as Michigan?
And I'm glad you used that phrase, what we now know as Michigan, because at one point, odd as it may seem, this was a territory. This was actually originally called the Northwest Territory, and it was part of this massive piece of land that we won from the British government during the American Revolution. It actually includes what are now the states of Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And when I first started this research a number of years ago, the general assumption was that there were five, maybe six settlements that were home to free people of African descent in those five states before the Civil War. By the time my book went to press, I'd found over 330 settlements. In fact, by about 1853 in the state of Michigan, all but nine counties had African American residents. That includes the UP. So at one point, Michigan was much more racially diverse than it is today. Not necessarily equal, but much more racially diverse. And the kind of people that were here, even before there was a United States, it really depends on when you're looking at this region. So along the Grand River or near Fort Detroit in the 1700s, you had Afro-French who were traveling this area, doing business in this area. They knew many languages. By the time the American Revolutionary War was won, they had been living in this region for three generations, marrying indigenous people, working with them, working with the French, and traveling all over this region. I've just been astounded by how far they could travel in one year. And then, of course, there were people who considered themselves Americans. And the people who came to this area may have been free from New England or the Deep South. Not a few of them were descended from Black patriots who had fought in the American Revolution.
Were they settling around people who they might have known from back home?
Yes, but it's sort of who those keystone pioneers were. Just as there were young white families or European descended families who just flung themselves out to the edges of the frontier, there were African descended families, many of them multiracial, who came out here before there were others. There always has to be a really early one, although I'm very, very cautious about saying first. There's one thing I have learned in this research is that if somebody tells me this is the first Black pioneer, I know that there's usually somebody earlier. The problem with that language of first is that oftentimes a story
historians won't look further back. But even just recently, I was hearing from somebody who said that they were studying their ancestor who was in British-occupied Fort Detroit by the early 1790s. So it's just amazing how early people were coming out to what we now know as Michigan.
The stories of Black pioneers are family stories. And also joining us today is Angelica Roberts. She's an artist living in Kalamazoo County and a longtime seeker of her own personal history. Angelica Roberts, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Tell me about your anecdotal sense of your family. What kind of stories did you hear when you were a young person?
Well, among the first stories I heard were about people who had settled in the Kalamazoo County area. So I first heard about Enoch and Deborah Harris from my grandfather because he would remind his young grandchildren about their history. He was very proud of it. They were his great-grandparents. So for me, three times great-grandparents. He would say, my great-grandparents were the first settlers on the Genesee Prairie. And he would talk about Enoch Harris. Now, the Genesee Prairie is no longer referred to as the Genesee Prairie. It's an area in Ashtamo Township of Kalamazoo County.
Mm-hmm.
But that knowledge was passed along. His son, my uncle, Dwayne Roberts, who became a civil rights activist in Kalamazoo, had foresight and also looked back at history. And he worked to preserve history in the family and worked to preserve the Harris history. So there is an historical, a Michigan historical marker now at the Genesee Prairie Cemetery on land that was actually once owned by Enoch and Deborah Harris in Kalamazoo.
How did you start your own investigations?
Well, I was certainly captivated as a child. I loved hearing the stories. I loved hearing the pieces. And over the years, in different ways, either I would go looking for stories or sometimes I felt like they came looking for me.
How so?
I've been fortunate in that I have found people who helped me along the way. My aunt, my father's sister, Barbara Roberts, I think of her as a story tender. She carried a lot. She had a wonderful memory. She was poking around in the past and we would get talking about the past and just wondering. So, for example, we had one scrap of information, and it was a piece about a family member on my grandmother's side, my father's mother's side, the Lennox family. And it was that there was a Nathan Lennox, this would have been my great-great-grandfather, who helped row freedom seekers across the Detroit River to freedom in Canada. Now, that was just a little piece, and we knew that the Lennox family had come from Massachusetts, the Boston area. We didn't know a lot more. And that's one of the stories that I've been learning about recently from another descendant. And it's really given me a lot of joy to discover some of their accomplishments. So Nathan's father was Cornelius. Cornelius had come from Massachusetts. In Massachusetts, the Lennox family was extremely active and working for full citizenship for all people. They were in well-known anti-slavery circles.
I believe there's some military history for the family too, right?
And there is. And Cornelius's father, Cornelius, in Massachusetts, who had fought at the Battle of Bunker Hill. And then Nathan had a sister who became involved in a well-known event where freedom seekers were trying to flee to Canada and were temporarily in a jail. This is the Blackburns in 1833. And Caroline visited, changed clothes with Ruthie Blackburn. And it was a dangerous escapade. But I've been hearing stories like that since I've been learning that Caroline and her husband, George, donated land to the Second Baptist Church there in Detroit. And that became a haven for freedom seekers.
Angelica, what kind of sense have you been able to get for what some of your ancestors' lives were like here in the early days, maybe even before statehood? I mean, I don't know if there would even be any physical artifacts that you could look to, but have any of these stories shed any light on sort of how they lived?
Well, it's really a matter of piecing things together and using imagination. Hearing stories from, my own family, but then also finding history, and then imagining from historical pieces what that tells about my family. You know, in my own family, there are stories of my grandfather talking about himself, you know, walking behind a plow. And so we can get a feel for, you know, what he knows of rural life, of farming life. So he had many farming stories. And these people were primarily working with agriculture, working to farm the land.
Right.
And I think that's an aspect of this history that is surprising to many people, is that the myth or the trope of the Midwest is that African-descended people are urban and mainly 20th century.
Harkening back to the Great Migration again.
Right.
Yeah.
But in reality, these African-descended pioneers were coming out before the 1860s, before the Civil War. This is at a time when the majority of people are not urban, and they are not urban. They are interested in owning good land and farming it well. The majority of African Americans in the Midwest before the Civil War were actually rural, and they were astoundingly successful farmers. One of Angelica's stories that I love is that Enoch and Deborah Harris came out of Ohio before Michigan was a state, and they had been friends with John Chapman, who a lot of school children know as Johnny Appleseed.
Wow.
And planted one of the first apple orchards in lower Michigan. They are some of our founders in a state that is known for its apple production, and yet they are bringing in to the state of Michigan an understanding of apple cultivation on the hundreds of acres that they owned. To be clear here, they're coming at a time when there are very few immigrants or pioneers in this region of Michigan. It's mainly indigenous people. And so successful and wealthy African-descended pioneers are going to be hugely visible in this space.
Mm-hmm. Annalisa Cox, did you get any sense in your research of what kind of reception the Black pioneers got when they came to the Northwest Territory? I mean, there were some territories and states that had specific laws that were pretty hostile to the entry of Black Americans.
Yes, although the earliest of these pioneers, for example, Angelica Roberts talked about members of the Lennox family, they were here by 1809. They're coming to this region in hope because the Northwest Territorial Ordinance of 1787 promised that the region would be free of slavery and have equal voting rights for all men, regardless of the color of their skin. So this is a period that's truly revolutionary. We think of equal voting rights as not happening until the 1960s, but this is the 1780s, the 1790s, where propertied African American men in the Midwest are going to the polls and voting. So they're coming in hope, and then there's a backlash. By 1819, whites in the territory of Michigan create a territorial ordinance which adds the word white into who can vote, thus stealing the right to vote from African American pioneers who were pivotal in founding this territory in this region.
Angelica Roberts?
Yes.
I understand that a lot of what you've had to work with has been in the form of stories and narrative, but did you find any legal records that give you hints to what Enoch and Deborah's lives were like and that of their extended family?
I have found clues, I guess, from all different directions. The story about them living in Ohio to John Chapman was something that came from another descendant that I discovered, Carl Lightfoot, and he had done research about their early days. So just in terms of dates and places and records, Enoch and Deborah's daughter, Louisa, was in Oshtemo Township, was the first marriage in that area. So there are things that can be discovered through records, either my own search or the searches of others. And then there's just, you know, intuition and imagination and the sense of what lives may have been like if you reflect going to the place, you know, knowing where your ancestors came from and just standing on the land and looking at the horizon that they saw. Much of their land where they had their homestead is still being farmed today. Certainly, records have helped, as well as writings by others. A lot of research has been done about the Roberts family and the migration of the Roberts family from North Carolina up through Indiana. There are a number of settlements of these free people of color, a number of communities were established there. and then Robert's family also came up to Michigan. The Roberts family kept a lot of papers, which are now in the Library of Congress.
I was just going to ask if those would be personal letters. I mean, that's a talk about a great historical record.
Yes, very helpful. Well, for example, there's one letter which appears in history books when my great-great-great-grandfather Willis Roberts traveled from North Carolina to Indiana and settled near Quakers with other community. He thought about going back to North Carolina, and he had a cousin who wrote him in letter said, and this was 1830s, it was right after the Nat Turner Rebellion, and there were a number of laws that were being changed in North Carolina, taking away rights of free people of color. And this cousin, who was called Long Jim, that was his nickname, James Roberts, the cousin said, why would you go back to a land where your children aren't safe? So that's one of the letters in those records. And I've since gone to reunions in Indiana and have met a descendant of Long Jim Roberts, which was very exciting.
That's so interesting that even in the times, which were pretty unsettled, that the perception was that it was definitely a safer environment than what they had left behind.
The fact that there wasn't slavery here, and I should be clear here, when the Territorial Ordinance of 1787 was written, there was absolutely slavery in Detroit and a lot of other places in the Northwest Territory. But the fact that it was actually illegal made a huge difference to the fact that people could raise their children away from that environment of brutal enslavement that was occurring and growing in the South.
Institutional brutality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there were also ways in which people were organizing against slavery for equality, for broader liberties in this region. And these free people of African descent were absolutely doing that. In fact, they created what were then called colored conventions. These are gatherings of hundreds of people. The first one in Michigan was 1843, just a few years after Michigan became a state. They would send out broadsides. And I think the idea of literate, legally savvy, highly organized, free African Americans in Michigan long before the Civil War is one that might be surprising to people. But they were doing so much to advance the causes of liberty and equality. There's a beautiful excerpt from one of those written broadsides that was sent out across the state of Michigan in 1843 to gather African Americans together in Detroit for the first convention. And I was wondering if Angelica Roberts could read it briefly. It's very brief, but it's so beautiful. Written.
Angelica, do you mind?
That would be fine. And I would just introduce this by saying that I believe that members of my family would have been active within this movement.
Mm-hmm.
The time has come for us to speak out in our own defense upon the great cause of human liberty and equal rights. Yes, yes, let us assemble. Let us come together and pledge ourselves in the name of God and bleeding humanity and posterity to organize. Organize and organize until the green-eyed monster tyranny shall be trampled under the feet of the oppressed, and liberty and equality shall embrace each other and shall have scattered their blessings along the length and breadth of our land.
Angelica Roberts, what kind of sense have you come to about how your family on both sides found their place, you know, through the years of early statehood and beyond, and, you know, maybe just why they stuck it out?
In my family, there's been a lot of support. My grandfather felt that, you know, in the early days of the rural communities, that people helped one another. So that wasn't always the case for every family, but there's been both. There has been that reaching out and the pushing away, and it's still going on, isn't it?
Right.
That's why it's so important to have these kinds of conversations to examine how we treat one another.
Angelica Roberts is a resident of Kalamazoo County. We've also been talking with Annalisa Cox, the author of The Bone and Sinew of the Land, America's Forgotten Pioneers, and The Struggle for Equality. Thank you both so much for all the work you've done, but also for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you, April. It's been a pleasure.
Yes.
That's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll catch up with you again tomorrow.